Well, I don't know how much of a demonstration it will be, because when we plug these vibrators in, sometimes they blow circuits. But I just want to start by acknowledging the irony of me, firmly stuck in the late 20th century Luddite, who cannot even get her shit together to put a PowerPoint presentation together. Maybe one of you nice people wants to teach me how to use that someday. Getting it together such that, at the very last possible minute, I had a technological difficulty with my late 20th century technology and had to bring the early 20th century technologies themselves along with me that I was going to show you slides of. But maybe that's good, actually. Actually, maybe handling your great-grandmother's vibrator will give some of you a far deeper understanding of, oh, I don't know, your great-grandmother's possible sources of pleasure than you've ever really considered, or give you a vicarious thrill, or somewhere on the spectrum between the two. And I guarantee you that since we have found these on eBay or under old ladies' beds in the sunset when we go estate sailing, they've all been wiped down. And I tell you that because I think we're going to pass them around, and I really implore all of you, don't take one home. You can find these on eBay. If you want a trophy of your very own, you can get them relatively easily. And especially, please don't steal the antique vibrating heating up butt plug. That would break my heart. Just in case any of you are the sorts of people who thought that sex was invented since your great-grandmother's time, and it's shocking, the notion that anyone, your great-grandmother or your great-grandfather, might have been using a butt plug. I hope I'm going to disabuse you of that right now. Really, the reason I wanted to go backwards instead of forwards or explore and delve more deeply into the present with this is that I think that the technologies of orgasm, as they've been called by the terrific Rachel Maines, who researched these things more than anybody has so far, of the past shed light, I think, on the future. Certainly, I think they shed light on the present. And if any of you want to see more antique vibrators than you see here, you can always look at the Antique Vibrator Museum at the goodvibes.com website. And better yet, if you have time, go up and look at the collection that's imagined after Bush wore that codpiece on that fucking aircraft carrier. It's not like that. It's a different kind of hysteria. A more pure kind of hysteria, sometimes, I think. And also, if you think that perhaps, really, when people go into vibrator stores or sex stores today or order things online, generally speaking, they know they're doing some sort of orgasm-seeking behavior, generally. That or they're buying a gag gift so that one of their friends in the office can have a surreptitious opportunity to do orgasm-seeking behavior, which is good, too, unless it gets you into sexual harassment problems there. I'm not going to speak to that today. But in those days, there was a little bit more nuanced cultural text about vibrators, and I want to try to explicate some of that, because it led directly, like the point of a wedge, to where we find ourselves today, with some interesting questions brought up along the way. And the other thing that I'd like to do is really to acknowledge that although I'm going to concentrate on this particular kind of technology in this particular period in our past, in Western past certainly, from about 1880 to about 1930 is where I'm mostly going to communicate about what was going on and bring you up to date on the ancient porn history. I really want to say that this kind of lecture could, had we had source materials for the era and the place, been developed about just about any place and time, I'm convinced, in human history. I want to remind everybody that technologies of any era will be brought to bear on things that people need and things that people desire. And what I'm going to talk about mainly is sex and entertainment, since I consider orgasm-seeking behavior and masturbation a form of entertainment. I'm not going to have the kinds of slides that my predecessor up here had, but I do want to say that I think that the health discussion that happened around antique vibrators slid inexorably into a different kind of discussion, which is how does the individual learn more about their body, pleasure themselves? Where does health turn into fun, which is where I think we want to more peg it now than we have in the future. And I just want to tell you an anecdote about why I think that at any place and time we could be having a different set of discussions about a different kind of sexual technology, because Robert and I were in the Museum of Natural History in New York several years ago, and we were looking around, and they had an awesome display from Mesopotamia, which, as you know, really no longer exists. And any ancient dildos that were in, I don't know, the National Museum of Iraq, which used to be Mesopotamia, probably been smuggled out, and probably the French have them. That's what I think. I wish I had one, but nobody has offered me one, and it would be wrong to buy it anyway. But we were standing there, we were looking at awesome things, and we saw a telltale shape. We walked over to the case. We looked in the case, a glass case full of ceramic fired dildos, not unlike those which artisans in our very own Bay Area are making, even as we speak. Looked out at us, and the label said that they were tent pegs. I have to say that Robert and I called it, well, we didn't call a curator over. A curator came over because we were laughing so hard. And, you know, it's kind of hallowed halls. You're not supposed to really belly laugh in a museum, and we were howling. And we were like, tent peg, tent peg. And so we asked the curator when he came over and asked us, could we please keep it down just a little bit? Would he explain to us how the museum's enlightened ones had come to the conclusion that you could take a ceramic item and pound it into the ground to hold up a tent? All right. The reason that I've got antique vibrators to show you at all, of course, is because of my affiliation with Good Vibrations. And the reason that Good Vibrations has antique vibrators to show and to talk about is because of Joni Blank, the founder of Good Vibes, who was had a master's in public health. But more importantly, and I'm not going to tell you anything that Joni wouldn't tell you herself if she were here, she got into adulthood without ever having an orgasm. And one day she was with a guy that she had had sex with, and he desultorily reached over, really desultorily. I think this sort of, the little picture of Joni is in the Encyclopedia Britannica next to the word desultory, as far as I'm concerned. Desultorily reached over and went diddle, diddle, diddle on her clit after they had fucked, and she came. Very first time in her whole entire life. And she's like, that's what it is. Now, if you learn anything here, it's that it's polite to diddle somebody if they didn't come when you were fucking. I think, right? I hope we're all past that. But just in case we're not, I just want to encourage people to, you know, share and share alike, do unto others, and so forth. Well, this was important to Joni, as you can imagine, and many people's first orgasm is important to them if it's not, lost in the dawns of preconsciousness in the sort of Freudian polymorphous era. If it happens when you're over 20, or in some cases when you're over 30, 40, 50, 60, or 70, it's an important and meaningful time often in women's lives. I know that's the case because so many of them have told me this, and I remember mine. It was important, and so Joni decided that orgasm was important, began to do the things that led to Good Vibrations, but one of the things she started to do was finding vibrators in flea markets and junk stores, and she was surprised to find them, because in those days it was a little harder than it is now to get vibrators. You could get them. You could get them at dirty bookstores, and there were already catalogs and things like that, but there weren't any of the sorts of places that we associate now with sort of post-feminist vibrator sales, if you will. She started to collect these vibrators, and when she did open Good Vibrations in 1977, she put a little museum of them out, like this many, really, not very many. I'm bringing you an entire museum's worth here right now. And people were mind blown. And the reason that it's worth, I think, me bringing these to talk to you in this context today is because people then were so mind blown, and to some degree are still mind blown now if they haven't been in a position, a sex-positive community, discourse about sexual histories. If people don't know about the practices that preceded us and our whacked out, that's fucked up.com practices, we can, especially, let me just say, if people had an American sex education without reference for supplemental materials to the internet. Because I don't think today that we can even talk about the lousy sex ed in our country without saying, why would people go and look at stuff on the internet? Because they don't get any fucking information that's useful anywhere else, that's why. And people are working it out for themselves in much the same way that I did in my day back when pterodactyls flew, when you had to actually look at pieces of paper to get any information. And pieces of paper were sometimes hard to come by. So I have to say it's better in every way, except for the worry that we're going to run out of electricity, which is, of course, the era that was that era of anxiety was introduced with the electric vibrator. Before electric vibrators, you had ones that you could hand crank, like your great grandmother's gizmo that you make whipped cream with at Thanksgiving. And those don't really exist anymore, although perhaps someone is going to have to invent them sometime soon, because in the you've all seen that terrible film, The Postman, where Kevin Costner delivers the mail again. When he's delivering the mail again, where will the vibrators come from for him to deliver? Is what I want to task those of you with who are developing technologies for the future, if there's an apocalyptic ability to think through how bad it's going to be if we can't plug our vibrator in anymore or get batteries, what are we going to do? Please work on that. Yes. I'm thinking solar. But hand crank could be a possibility as well. I know that there are some innovators in this audience who have used actual human motion, because the Monkey Rocker people are here, to get people off without with a low carbon footprint, as was already mentioned. So the museum, this collection, had a true importance in shaking up people's assumptions. Oh, I thought we were the first generation to want to stick buzzing pieces of plastic between our legs and get off. Oh, no. Your great-grandmother was doing that. And somehow that, especially for the women of the 70s and the 80s, prior to the great influx of information available now to people, if people, in fact, are not Luddites and go out and find it, was a normalizing experience for them. It was a click moment, as we used to say in feminism, the moment where something that you've observed for a long time finally, the plug makes its socket, if you will, and you go, oh, that has great cultural significance, or oh, that's been totally meaningful for me, that's changed my life, that's affected my life. So the click moment of seeing the old vibrator that might have come from great-grandma's bed or in her nightstand table was important. Now, let me just tell you where they came from, because I think this is the most important piece of this narrative. Somebody in the late 1800s just didn't say, I'm going to form a sex toy company. Although, if they had done so, I hope they would have been wildly successful. We know there were artificial vaginas in those days. We know there were dildos. I have seen ancient pictures of strap-ons, both Western and Eastern. We didn't just invent sex toys, although we may have invented ways of mass producing and mass distributing them. The medical profession brought us the vibrator. Is really sort of the crux of this. The medical profession, the people that you go to now, ask sex questions, and because they only got about 3 or 4 hours of sex information at med school, which was supposed to encompass all of reproductive biology and anatomy, often cannot answer your question, and in fact, they should be watching more movies produced right in this place, and they'd have a whole lot more information. That's my personal opinion. So, again, I want to call out Rachel Maines, because she was the academic who actually decided to go and dig through source materials to get information about this. Sexologists knew about the role of the vibrator, but Rachel Maines got more information than was commonly acknowledged. The vibrator was developed to combat hysteria. I mentioned hysteria before. Here's what hysteria was. We don't know what hysteria was. Hysteria was something that women were diagnosed with from the time of Galen onward into the 19th and early 20th centuries. It probably had something to do with sexual frustration born of not having orgasms on a regular basis, but having sex anyway, and the enormous amount of stress it took and work it took to manage the technologies of various times. If any of you saw the 1901 House reality show a few years ago, you'll know that to do anything in 1901, until you got electricity, it took an enormous, enormous amount of labor. So there was maybe a little post-traumatic stress syndrome, what we would call it now, thrown in there. There was a lot of different things that made women very stressy, very sort of fragile, even though they tended to be having to do a lot of things anyway. And I say we don't know really what hysteria was, because hysteria doesn't exist anymore except in the form that we saw when George Bush and his codpiece, etc. And the reason why hysteria doesn't exist anymore is part of the story of this particular sexual technology. I'm going to get to it in a minute. It was likely a mix of these things that we have sort of separated out and put into different categories. Many of them still perhaps a little dubious, medically speaking, because, of course, medicine is culturally impacted, and we know that. But it was found that orgasm relieved it. And that was good, because if you had something without a cure that was afflicting lots of women, that was sad and bad for the women, possibly bad for society. If getting a woman off would make her feel better, that's awesome. But who was telling women about orgasms in those days? No one, that's who. No one. In fact, there's probably a great argument for the fact that doctors who had access to these technologies didn't know they were producing orgasms in the women they treated. They were calling it hysterical paroxysms of relief. And can I get a show of hands how many of you have ever felt as though it was a hysterical paroxysm of relief? Men too, you know. I think there have been hysterical men as well. Galen talked about this stuff way back, at the dawn of what we might call modern medicine, but which doesn't seem very modern anymore. But Galen saw this connection between this set of problems and the relief given by sexual orgasm. Galen thought, and the docs of his time, that hysteria, and this is what gave it its name, was caused by the womb coming loose from its moorings, whatever they were, and wandering around your body, causing trouble in various kinds of places. So if you had mostly sort of psychological manifestations of hysteria, it was possible that the womb had gotten all the way up into your brain. My experience is that my womb never enters my brain, but that my vagina sometimes does. Perhaps some of you have had similar experiences, but the womb not so much. Although I've known some women who were so hot to have a child before some age when an alarm was going to ring that perhaps Galen was right about the womb going into the brain too. Who knows? Anyway, Galen, who was, by the time of the Middle Ages, just the threshold before the changes that these really, really document and manifest, who was doing the hand jobs on the hysterical women who needed hysterical paroxysms of relief so that they could feel better and go back and sustain their other responsibilities? Midwives, that's who. At a lower paid class of female medical providers who did other stuff as well, but who apparently, just like Joni's then boyfriend, did a little diddling experience. Midwives are very dexterous. And this doesn't surprise me in the least to find this out. We don't know how they felt about it. We don't know how they, in fact, understood it, but we have records that's who doctors were getting to do the work, like when the nurse comes in and takes your temperature now, only probably a lot more full of pleasure and relief for the patient. Midwives. Eventually, the system that midwives represented, a female-centric form of healthcare and knowledge, began to be supplanted by the dawnings of the medical profession that we know now, where it was mostly guys until the, you know, a couple of cross-dressed ladies went to med school, and then finally they let them wear bustles, and then, you know, and then it brings us up to today, pretty much. And the hand job piece was taking too long. Really, that was the problem. We're lucky. Joni was lucky that this guy was patient. The hand job thing was just taking too long. And especially if you got a person who wasn't, in fact, in an erotic state at all, in a sexual state, it may take a little while to get them into a state of arousal sufficient. Whether or not they recognize it as arousal is another question. Sufficient to actually have an orgasm. That's one of the problems with female and male sexual function now, is that if you're taking too short a time to have sex, the sex that you have is not optimal. Just in case any of you have those little special alarms on your computer, like for carpal tunnel prevention, that ring and tell you when to have sex, but they don't give you very long to do it, I encourage you to set the alarm for a longer phase, because your orgasms will be stronger if you have sexual stimulation for a longer period of time. I can tell by looking at you that some of you have discovered this already, but I know that many of you are in the technology professions and you're very, very busy. So I just want to, I mean, that's just a freebie for me, but please, if you're going to have sex, at least occasionally have sex for a longer period of time. It'll be good for you, I promise. It's good for your health. I'll explain why in a minute. Well, but then the Industrial Revolution came along and things became available to people. The things had always been available to people, but more things became available, many more things, as the Industrial Revolution ground along. And so by the time the first step in through the door of this discussion happened, it wasn't midwives anymore. It had moved to a technological space where doctors had access to hydrotherapy. Yes, running a hose on the clit, just like you do at home in your bathtub, if your cooch will fit under the water stream. And if it hasn't, since you're a technological crowd, I know that you've all figured out a way to attach a hose so that you can just hold the hose right there. And you can do it in your backyard with a hose, but I suppose you have to worry about who can see you, but perhaps you don't worry about that at all. Water induced orgasm, and actually spas in Europe and the United States developed water rooms. There are images of women dressed, wrapped in nothing but wet swaddling sheets, which would be right at home on that website we just saw, with a huge hose of water aimed right at their genitals, and the women were spreading their legs, holding themselves in their chairs and staying put, because it was good for them. It was good for them. That's where they started to eat cornflakes, too. But never mind that. That's a different lecture altogether, and I don't know very much about that. Except that I do know that cornflakes were developed so that you wouldn't get horny from the breakfast food you ate. And I'm guessing it was meant to supplant little sausages, but I'm not sure about that. That's just a thought. The huevos were probably a problem as well. Hydrotherapy was too wet, though. The doctors couldn't have hydrotherapy in their offices unless they retooled their offices. So steam-powered vibrators were then made available. They were enormous. They looked like dentist drills. I'm sorry I don't have one to show you here today, because the kink.com people would doubtless want me to leave it here because it looks so menacing and frightening. It would go right into the fuck machine site perfectly and look really good in this dungeon to boot. But they were... I mean, if you imagine what a dentist drill must have looked like in 1870, you've got about the right picture without the drill on the end. Instead, it was usually a wooden or some other kind of solid material knob, which, as we know today, is not a bad size or shape for clitoral stimulation. And then the electric motor was made available on a more mass basis. Electricity first. Of course, went to people who could afford it, and that included doctors. And so the folks who had been making the steam-powered ka-thumpa-thumpa-thumpa-thumpa vibrators said, oh, we could actually make something a little smaller for you, doc, here, buy this now. And the doctors did. There were doctors who traveled Europe and the United States in those days, teaching other doctors how to use the new technologies, explaining what a labor-saving technology it was. People took this perfectly seriously. Mrs. Smith would go in every single week to get her treatment from Dr. Feelgood because she felt better at the end of her treatment and nothing like that was happening to her at home. It's more than likely that almost none of these Mrs. Smiths understood that they were having a sexual experience. And as I said before, it's very likely that the majority of the doctors didn't understand it either. There was very little public discourse about female sexuality. There wasn't an enormous amount about male sexuality either. But as we know from looking at the pornography of the time, there was at least a space made culturally for male sexuality as well or as little as it was understood. And if you read things like The Pearl and Casanova's Diaries and some of the older porn novels that putatively aren't novels but that in fact are memoirs, and maybe some of them really are, there are plenty of things going on in that time frame and before. They just weren't part of public discourse in the way that we would name orgasm-seeking behavior, understanding of arousal, and so forth, to be part of public discourse today, because even if people aren't being taught about it in school, you can easily go right over to a Ladies' Home Journal, even if you can't find the internet. So there are places to find at least discussion about these things now that didn't exist yet, which made it perfectly logical on... in a look back way to see a bunch of doctors giving vibration and stimulation of that kind to female patients, not understanding what was going on, but finding that patients came back over and over again, and therefore it was good and it was worthy. So The hysterical paroxysms of relief went on unimpeded until the very, very end of the 19th century. And what began to impede hysterical paroxysms of relief for doctors was the fact that the factory owners went, well, the doctors are buying them up. We can think everybody else will buy them up too. And a public acknowledgement of the good of vibrators became very above ground. By 1905 or 1910, you could find them in Sears catalogs, monkey wards. You could find them advertised, Rachel Maines, found in needlework magazines. If you looked at embroidery today, you would see Cruel Floss. That's C-R-E-W-E-L. It's not the kind of floss we use today here at kink.com. It's not that kind of Cruel Floss. Cruel Floss! Vibrator! And the reason that Rachel did this research in the first place was she went, vibrator? What's a vibrator doing in my great-grandmother's needlework magazine? Well, it was trying to get her great-grandmother to buy a vibrator. Why? Because vibrators were good for health, vigor, and beauty. This one says, what does this one say? Easy, effective, feels wonderful. It's true, isn't it? It really is. And this one, the Vibra King, look better, feel better, live better. Now, this is mid-20th century capitalism and the ad person's art encroaching by the time I show you these boxes. And this was going on well before that. But in the ads from 1905, you can see this kind of language. And the health, vigor, and beauty trope had always, just below the surface, this sort of sexual vigor implied. It wasn't always said in so many words. If you read the books that came along with a vibrator, sometimes you could see acknowledgments about how vibrators were good for everything, including sexual issues. And the way that the sexual issues are described was pretty interesting. Let me now just say a couple of more things while we pass some of these vibrators around so that you can feel them up, if people would like to. Robert, would you be willing to hand the vibrators around? I think he's going to hand them around in a more or less chronological order. I just want to note on the electrical butt plug that you had to have electric lights in your house in order for the heat part to work, because you could put a light bulb in there. Amazing. The light bulb was not supposed to go up your ass. I don't care what Dr. Rubin said and everything you always want to know about sex. This part. That one is from the 30s. This is before all the metal in America got used for making airplanes and bombs. You could still get a metal vibrator. And these days, only just recently, have metal vibrators come back into vogue with Jimmy Jane and those folks. And then we have what happened after all the metal was gone. Here's the Vibra King that goes with this box. Celluloid. Celluloid. You know, there are collectors who just love celluloid. And these are actually very styled. My very first vibrator in the world, this isn't it, I wore mine out, but I stole it from my parents who had it. I believe that my parents had never, in fact, used it. Vanna will show you how it was used. You put it on the back of your hand. This is a Swedish massager. This is the Stimulax from the Oster Company. And the Oster Company is still extant, and they make, you know, hair clippers, as does the Wall Company, the metal one that I passed around. Yes, it is super heavy. It could give you carpal tunnel if you were too into masturbating. Not only that, you may notice when you see it that it has little springs for straps. I can tell you with a great amount of authority that those will rip out your pubic hair altogether if you're too into masturbating. But, of course, that's in now, so I don't suppose it's a big problem. Only the people who like the lots of pubic hair, and there are sites for them too, of course. You know who you are. Only those people are going to be really sad about that. This is a thermo gizmo also. Another vibrate. What, Robert?
It vibrates.
Yeah, it vibrates too. And note that they're actually bringing design to bear on these things. At a certain point, these became so common and comfortable for people to own that industrial designers started going, oh, I can make a better looking one. Oh, I can make one out of aluminum that's green toned. And if you shift it this way, it sort of turns purple, just like our cars. It's extremely heavy, yeah. That's because in these days, we see motors that have plastic parts. And in those days, oh no, they're all metal. It's a little coronet beauty patter. I can just see what would happen if you got your clit stuck in there. No, it could be great. Come on, people, remember where you are. Here's one made of wood. Wood. And we believe that this was an Amway model. And for those of you who don't know what Amway is, it's one of those things where the lady comes to your house and sells you, it's like a Tupperware party, only she sells you spices or Tupperware or vibrators, apparently. This was big in the 50s. That's where you got your vibrators. I don't know why the bottom of this looks so gnarly, except that time takes its toll on nearly everything. But this is a fine Plan 9 from Outer Space inspired vibrator made by the Handy Hannah Company. And Handy Hannah didn't make all their vibrators looking like this. They were around for 20 or 30 years at least. I've seen Handy Hannahs from the 30s through the 50s. Now just enjoy those. And when you look at them, know that all of them vibrate more strongly, for the most part, than battery-operated vibrators that you might have seen now. And really the true descendants of these vibrators that I'm showing you are the Hitachi Magic Wand, the wall coil, the other coils that you can find that you need to plug in to a power source. So let me just say a couple more things about the heyday of these vibrators and tell you why they're in museums now instead of most of these companies still being extant. As I said, electricity in the home was the real cultural change that allowed the means of orgasmic production to go into the hands of the people. We were wondering what Marx would have to say about it. I think that's what he'd have to say, or something. Engels would weigh in on whether or not it was the gendered responsibility of the male of the household to do the orgasm-giving behavior to the woman. Maybe he would say that. I don't know. We do know that plenty of people knew, both members of the couple, what these were. We've heard responses from our great-grandparents saying, oh, yeah, we had one of them. And the other thing that we know is that it was not a secret to man after about 1920, 1925, because vibrators began to appear in pornography. And I totally encourage, I apologize for not having a clip to show you. I really encourage you to look at some of the old-fashioned porno. It's so cute. It's so sweet. Your great-grandmother looks awesome getting reamed. Awesome. She was beautiful. She always had such a sweet smile on her face. And somehow the hairstyles and the fact that the guys had their stocking garters still on half the time, you know, they're doing all the same things that we're doing on our websites now for the most part, except in old-fashioned underwear, and it just looks charming. Which I think tells us something sexologically significant, which is that when we're seeing people of our own generation or in our own time with all of the signifiers of our own time depicted in ways that we recognize as pornographic in our own time, we recognize it as porn. And older explicit material doesn't look quite that pornified. In fact, in many cases, it starts to look downright artistic. So I'm just asking you for one instant to envision the future when they stumble upon the time capsule with the images that we've seen already today, and they'll go, oh, that's so artistic. What will they be watching then? One wonders. Or will they be watching? Will they have those... You know, Good Vibrations had this Sex Toys You Wish Existed contest a few years ago, which was supposed to get the technologic and futuristically minded among us to throw down what they thought the sex toy of the future would be. We said, even if the technology to do it hasn't yet been invented. And I just want to tell you what the winning entry was so that you all can get busy on this, because I'm looking forward to it. And I cannot make it myself. I certainly know that. Something that you can embed, allowing your nerves, your entire neurology, to experience someone else's fuck. Because then we would know whether Britney Spears was orgasmic and all kinds of things that might be useful. And I'm just sorry that they didn't invent this to catch James Dean. That's my feeling about the situation. But maybe there'll be time travel by then and it'll be possible. All right, so there were more vibrators in United States homes than toasters, electric toasters, in 1917. I just want to leave you with that as a fun fact for your next cocktail party. I know that all of you have at least one friend who would think that was a cool statistic. And as the sexual use became increasingly apparent less than a decade later, as pornography became available at least to men on a relatively regular basis, because guys would drive around the country with porn in the trunk of their car, and they would go down to the Moose Lodge and they would have all the guys in town come in, or they would do it at the fire department or wherever they did it. This was the sex education, that and the eight pagers of those days, except for those people who had the wherewithal to get hold of one of the contemporary successful marriage type manuals, many of which were more sensible than we from today's vantage point might give them credit for. And in fact, if we gave a 1927 marriage manual to a high school student today, it would be far better sex education than they're getting in school, but still a little dated. As the sexual use became increasingly apparent through their depiction in pornography, doctors began to rely less on them. It was much more obvious once the mister had come home and told the missus, oh, you know that thing you got because your doctor used it? Well, guess what it really is? And the missus said, oh, you mean, well, I don't need to go back to that doctor anymore. And anyway, we're having too much fun at home, and I'm feeling so much better, Jim, since we started to use that gizmo every couple of nights. I don't think I have any physical problems at all now, because vibrators increase blood flow. Circulation is good for your general health. It's optimally good for your sexual health, because if you have poor circulation and if you're still smoking cigarettes, listen to me here. Not only do I not want to breathe your secondhand smoke, I don't want to think about your poor clit or dick not getting all the blood it needs to have an optimal arousal cycle and orgasm. It's just sad. It's just sad. Just please think about that. So that in the early 1950s, hysteria was removed altogether from the medical lexicon. They voted it out of the medical books. A bunch of doctors sat around a big table, I think in a room much like this, and said, this hysteria business, we're going to the cleaners. Everybody's pointing and laughing. They're watching the porno movies that Vic Tanney's wife. Does anybody know who Vic Tanney even was in this day and age? You're all too young. Vic Tanney was a guy who was like the pre-Charles Atlas of his day. He was the guy who sold you on gym equipment and classes to use the gym equipment so that you would be big and strong. He was a Bowflex guy, kind of, only there wasn't a Bowflex yet. And Vic Tanney had a beautiful wife. And Vic Tanney's beautiful wife, thank you for returning, oh, the butt plug's back. Vic Tanney had a beautiful wife who, right around the time that the docs voted hysteria out of the medical books, had a notorious porno movie come out called The Nun, which is possible that some of you have seen, because I know that some of you have nun fetishes, I can tell just by looking. And this was one of the earliest, although not the earliest piece of nun fetish porn. Actually, we have found earlier nun fetish porn from Mexico, where anybody they could get to come out of the brothel for the day put on a habit and had a fuck fest with the very earliest cameras that went down to Mexico, and they're awesome. But The Nun featured Vic Tanney's wife, a pretty high-profile woman, and there she was in her nun's habit, and then the one who has the vibrator that rips your pubic hair out, just if you want to hold that up so people can envision this. Yeah, the one with the little straps that Robert put on his hand. Anyway, that one, she's using it in a way that makes it completely clear what's going on. And the doctors went, we give up. We're not going to use vibrators anymore. Come to think of it, there's no such thing as hysteria, and there never was. We're just going to vote it out of the medical book. So embarrassed were the doctors. I like to think about that. Because, you know, it's one thing to have received wisdom from your profession, from your culture. And it's another thing to receive the wisdom uncritically and just continue to buy new BMWs every year for your entire career. Those are just two different things in my mind. And so the docs had to find new things to do. So soon they were circumcising even more young American boys. And, I mean, they came up with things to do instead. But hysteria was no longer extant. And as a result, the vibrator had a gray area for a few years before the light switch flicked completely over to it being understood as a sexual device. Now most of us don't think of it as a health device at all, although, as I mentioned, blood flow is healthy. So they were right about all this health, vigor, and beauty shit. They were absolutely right about it. They just didn't put it in the same kind of terms. They didn't sexualize it in the same kind of way that we would do now. If anything, we probably don't talk enough about health now when we talk about sexual functioning, or when health becomes attached to talk of sexual functioning, it strays too far away from the interesting and enticing realm of pornography, so many people don't stay there. Instead, they switch to the next most interesting website. I just want to parallel. Now, this is, as I said at the beginning, this is all old-fashioned as can be, and I don't mean to take you far in the past and take your attention away from the future, necessarily, except to say that I think that the past sometimes influences and in some ways maybe predicts the future. And I don't know about you, but when I think about a specialized industrial use that was popularized and brought into the hands of the people, I think about these and I think ARPANET to Apple. I think that any technology that is currently not in the hands of the people is likely on some level, well, maybe not bombs. Well, no bombs, too. Sorry. Is likely to get into the hands of people in some context or another. And if any technology that exists can be focused on the needs of people and the entertainment of people, then certainly there are going to be many, many other opportunities to meld sexuality and technology. I'm guessing you're going to brainstorm a new one here this weekend. I have to get on a plane today, so I can't take part in that, which really bothers me. But I do want to say that if that and this experience, the vibrator experience and the computer, personal computer and internet experience, predict the future, what they predict is that that gizmo that I want you to invent so that I can feel what it was like to be fucked by James Dean, or be fucked as James Dean, can exist using the technologies that people are developing now to help brain-damaged people lead more full lives. Pretty soon, somebody's going to sneak something out of the lab, and then, boo-ha, you're going to be able to plug something into some part of you that is going to allow you to experience differently sexual stimulation. And my guess is that it will have a visual component, because the culture right now seems to have such a great fascination for visuals. But I think that there's a form of pornography, if pornography is a sexualized entertainment medium, that will allow us to experience pornography in the body, not necessarily see it. It's going to potentially get less voyeuristic, or maybe on some level, on a much more embodied level, it will get more voyeuristic. Oh, just a thought. I'm just riffing now. Robert, when I was getting ready, Robert is not just Vanna, as any of you who know him know, and he was riffing with me this morning as I was thinking about coming in and talking to you, which is why I couldn't get a freaking PowerPoint presentation together, because I knew that I would think of things while I was speaking to you that I wouldn't think of at my computer by myself. Robert said, and this is a direct quote from him, feel free to write it down if you like, but please attribute it, any new technology which may be used to communicate info of any sort between two humans will be used for a sexual purpose. Well, think of an exception to that. I can't think of an exception to that. He also has a corollary, which is a little more paranoid, but then that's Robert. And just because you're not paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. The larger society will, as soon as the technology is found, attempt to use it to suppress such use, the sexual use, while co-opting it for political purposes. I don't actually think that I can argue with that either, and perhaps that would make a good last word, except I do want to say that the thing that makes this notable is the fact that the culture in which we live here, at least in the United States, doesn't want to give us the wherewithal to have a full sexuality. It doesn't want to give us information. It doesn't want to put any money into research. It doesn't want to help us understand it any better. And what's happened? We've decided to do that ourselves. And so the larger culture, counterculture thoughts that the preceding speaker was riffing on, I think, need to be continually riffed on. It seems clear to me that this is one space of human experience that we will not let alone. Thank goodness there is masturbation, the sole glimmer of light in this darkness. Camus really said gin, but, you know, I find that even people who are sober like masturbation oftentimes, so I'm changing it. And so if those of us who have ideas about where we're going to go in the future also have technological wherewithal or meet people who do, in 50 years, the lecture about, oh, that old technology might be something that we have yet to envision or are only just envisioning now. And I can't wait. I hope I live that long. I know many of you are going to live that long. And I hope that some thoughts about the past will shed interesting light on the future. Thanks.
We are way over time, but I think we have like one or two questions for Carol Queen, please.
I just had a really quick question. The U.S. Supreme Court turned down even looking at a case in Alabama. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with this. They, a sex toy shop is not going to be allowed to sell toys in the state of Alabama. However, Alabama will allow you to bring in toys from other states. How do you think states that are that conservative, how do you think small business and other people will be able to get around that, because it's such a hurdle?
Is this one on too? Good. I'm going to let the mic stay out in the audience and speak to that from here. Let me just catch people up who might not know the history of this case. Since about 1987 or 8, Alabama has made sex toys illegal. There are 6 or 7 states in the union that do this. You've probably all heard about Texas, which won't allow you to own more than 5 vibrators or dildos because it's considered intent to distribute. Whereas we all know that it's just evidence of polyamory. Silly Texans. By the way, there's a wonderful documentary called Dildo Diaries about that situation in Texas that Good Vibes and the Center for Sex and Culture are going to bring to the Roxy next month. So please try to keep an eye out for that. It's awesome, awesome movie. And so Alabama became the most recent state to add that statute to its list of statutes. Generally, the statute is much older, but Alabama revamped its obscenity statute, and what's happening frequently these days, there's actually a similar fight going on in Ohio right now. Some legislation that is meant to abate strip clubs and live sex shows is actually going to potentially abate sales of porn materials and toys as well from stores. So they didn't necessarily expect to abate stores. They weren't even thinking that there were stores, the Alabama State Legislature. And apparently one of the wives of one of the legislators really kicked his ass when he came home and told her what he had done at work that day. I would like to be a fly on the wall for that. But the woman who has been fighting this, Sherry Williams, has been fighting it for about 10 years now. And she wanted very much to get it to the Supreme Court and hoped for a sensible ruling, which it's this Supreme Court, people, so I'm not sure she actually was ever going to get a good ruling. It may be that their refusal to look at this is better than them, in fact, ruling on it on some level, because then at least we don't have a Supreme Court level precedent that, yes, it's fine to abate sex toys any place you want to, because that would ruin everything. But how people will get sex toys from Alabama, I think, is pretty clear. They're going to get them through mail order right now. That's where they're going to get them. They're going to get them via everyplace.com that has vibrators, because the specific language actually sort of leaves a loophole for that. And we were worried initially that it wasn't going to leave such a loophole, but it really appears to. And so internet access is even more important to Alabamans than it ever was as of this week. Good Vibes was going to do an emergency airlift of vibrators years ago, but then we realized that we might hit people with the vibrators when we dropped the packages, and that was not going to be good. We believe in safer sex, and we didn't want to kill anyone. We poor orgasm-starved Alabamans, we just didn't want to do it. It just seemed unethical. So that's where it is now, and I would say that, I mean, really one of the things that this says to us is that in the very late waning days of the 20th century, and right now, a new stupid law against sexual behavior was passed in the United States, and this sort of thing is on the the drawing boards of legislatures all over the country and federally too, not specifically about vibrators necessarily, but to abate porn, as you know, and any place where people might get sexually entertained or even in many cases good sexual information. So we have to stay vigilant about those things. The reason that I have to fly away and can't stay with you is because I'm a board member of the Woodhull Freedom Foundation, which is a national organization that deals with this exact kind of thing. So we're gonna talk up the Supreme Court case tomorrow in our board meeting, I'm sure. Is there one more question?
Okay, I think you wanted to... It was you. Okay, good. Just to add, it's always a pleasure to being in your free-ish country. It's great.
Did you guys hear the ish on the end of that?
Yeah.
Hey, I heard an awesome story about sex toys when I was in Germany just now. Let me just tell you what it is. Beate Uhse, who was a lady who started a sex toy chain in the 50s, by the time the wall fell, was a big, big company in Germany. And every Eastern German got $100 worth of play money to welcome them to capitalism. And Beate Uhse got a fleet of vans, and she sent vans deep into East Germany to all the little villages where they hadn't even seen a fresh banana for years and years and years. And if you don't have fresh bananas, you know, you can't use them as dildos or put them on your muesli in the morning. And so she went out and she got coupons to everyone, and she made a freaking ton of money because they were so hungry for vibrators in East Germany. Now that should tell you a lot.
Carol, yeah. I was just going to kind of follow up the previous question about dildo availability mm-hmm. in like Alabama. Was that legislation a response to porn being manufactured in the 50s or a response to feminism in the 70s?
My understanding is that it's more a part of obscenity laws than a response to feminism. I don't know of any link that suggests directly that it was a response to feminism, but certainly if you see Dildo Diaries, you'll see a real good old boy who is no friend of women's causes, and you'll see women from the Texas State Legislature who are rolling their eyes big time about what kind of an impact this has on essentially women's sexuality, although I should say commercially, non-commercially too, if fellows, you haven't tried vibration, you should just go try it as soon as possible because you have all the same nerve endings that I do. And you should play with them.
Just on the thought of things that come out of the laboratory that were invented for non-sexual uses, I would say that by far the most important in our present age is Viagra, which was invented as an antidepressant, I believe, and it had no sexual intent. And it's probably, I would say, by far the most important cultural technology to emerge in sex in the last decade or so.
At least as far as cute TV commercials are concerned. Those are cute commercials. Yeah, it was a lab accident, Viagra. They had heart medication hopes for Viagra, and then somebody staggered out of the testing room going, "My heart on it won't go down," and the rest is totally history.
It's Pfizer, isn't it? Or
mm-hmm.
Viagra? Pfizer.
Pfizer.
Like Bush Senior was working for them.
Or
is it Lilly?
Bob Dole was doing some ads for them. That was pretty cute. Yeah, Liddy might have been working for them on the sly. You never know. I actually was invited to a Pfizer conference where they were clearly talking. They never said in so many words, but they were clearly talking about Miss Viagra, the next generation. So, ladies, if you are jealous of all the pills the guys get to pop, if there will be one for you soon enough, I don't know how it'll work, but that's a technology that is inescapable in my view.
Okay, so like one last question, and the next thing, please, like
okay.
In person.
Then I'll get out of here.
I just wanted to like make sure I heard you right. That you were saying that you thought that the initial like masturbating women to relieve them for their hysteria, that there's no reason to believe that was sexual. It seems like perfectly good Lacanian example of like at the level of discourse and power, there's this one thing that's going on, but everybody really knows what's going on, and people have been masturbating forever.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. However, that it wasn't acknowledged as sexual is really what I meant, and that it wasn't understood as sexual by many is also what I meant, because in the period of time where it wasn't acknowledged that women had orgasms at all, I mean, this was not part of the discourse. It wasn't how to get your Victorian wife to have an orgasm so she'll feel more satisfied and really live up to her role as the angel in the home. It was, we're not talking about these things at all to speak of. And when many of you know that interesting erotic artwork and architectural bits came out of Pompeii and Herculaneum in the latter part of the 19th century, and they were housed in the British Museum, and women were not allowed to go and look at them. I mean, I maybe underspoke the level of repression of women's sexuality just 100 years ago. Women were not allowed to see the brothel wall decor, the hanging penises that lit on fire so you could tell where the street corner was, or any of the other cool stuff they had in Herculaneum and Pompeii. So there was, for a woman who had never had an orgasm before and didn't understand what it was, obviously a physical reaction that involved pleasure, involved her genitals, but whether she put those two things together and whether, in fact, some of the doctors put two and two together is really dubious. I'm going to get off the stage now. I'm going to let this go on. Thank you so much, Johanna.
Thank you.
Thanks for everybody.